This is the fifth day of this January 2011 seven-day session. And we will return to our text. I've been saying the name of this book is The Collected Works of Chinua, because that's what's on the front cover of the book. But it turns out that's the subtitle. So, rewind, what we've been reading all this time is called The Korean Approach to Zen, with a subtitle of The Collected Works of Chinua by Robert Buswell, Jr. Yesterday we left off with Chinua talking at length about sudden awakening followed by gradual cultivation or ongoing practice after awakening. And he says here, just to sum up, he says, "Hence, sudden awakening and gradual cultivation are like the two wheels of a cart. Neither one can be missing." And then he continues. "Some people do not realize that the nature of good and evil is void. They sit rigidly without moving and, like a rock crushing grass, repress both body and mind. To regard this as practice, cultivation of the mind, is a great delusion. And he says, as it is said, do not fear the arising of thoughts, only be concerned lest your awareness of them be tardy. Let's just comment on this, because there's a lot in this sentence, a lot I wish I had understood much earlier in my practice, that goes right to the very heart of Zazen. Do not fear the arising of thoughts. Okay, so thoughts will always be in the mind. It's just the function of a normal living brain to generate thought activity. Just as our stomach generates gastric juices, our brain generates thoughts. That's part of its job. So the last thing we want to do is pick a fight with our thoughts. We're always going to have some degree of thought activity. But then he says, only be concerned lest your awareness of them be tardy. That's what it all comes down to, is how quickly can we notice the thoughts? And then, having noticed them, how quickly can we just redirect our attention back to the practice? Because we can be lost in thought for the longest time without noticing it. And suddenly, it's like, you know, the morning alarm going off, and we realize that we've been lost in thought for the longest time. There's nothing we can do about getting back to the practice until we notice our mind has wandered. So the key thing is to notice as quickly as possible when the mind has strayed, and then as soon as we notice, right, just drop it. Get right back to the practice. I put it this way. We want to notice that there are thoughts while ignoring what the thoughts are. That's a difference of, I don't know, few milliseconds maybe. But it's a really vital distinction. Noticing that they're there, but not getting involved in them at all. And he continues, again he's quoting, "It is also said, if we are aware of a thought at the moment it arises, then through that awareness it will vanish." Something very profound about this also, that the noticing itself is liberating. It's once we notice it, then we're not under the power of the thought. And that's when, as we just recited in the Hakuin chant, our thought now being no thought. Just to go back a few lines where he says, "Some people do not realize the nature of good and evil is void." That good and evil are categories that we construct. There's a lot of consensus on what is good and evil. There's a lot of disagreement too, but in any case, it's all conceptual. It's stuff that it's thoughts. And as thoughts, ultimately, there's nothing to them. Now we know that there are actions and words and thoughts that create harm, that are unwholesome. Suppose you could call that evil, and there are the opposite. But these as abstract categories, good and evil, we give them much more power than they deserve. They can really have a very disturbing effect on the mind. Especially when we use them in reference to our own self. I'm a good person, I'm an evil person, I'm bad, I'm this or that. But really they're fundamentally empty. Just as the self is empty. The next chapter is called Straight Talk on the True Mind. And this was, the editor tells us, is probably written about the same time as the chapter we just read, Secrets on Cultivating the Mind. It was when Chinuo was about 38, 37. And the editor calls this probably Chinuo's most accessible exposition of Zen meditation techniques practiced in his era. And he starts off by quoting the Avatamsaka Sutra, "Faith is the fountainhead of the path and the mother of all meritorious qualities. It nourishes all good roots." Then he then he says, "Moreover, the consciousness only texts say, faith is like a water purifying gem which can purify cloudy water. it is clear that faith takes the lead in the development of the myriad wholesome qualities. For this reason, the Buddhist sutras always begin with, "Thus have I heard," an expression intended to arouse faith. And then question, what difference is there between faith in the patriarchal Zen and in the patriarchal Zen and the scholastic sects? So again, as we said early in Sesshin, at this time in Korea, there are basically two monastic schools, the scholastic or the sutra studying school and the meditation school. Chinil says there are many differences. The scholastic sects encourage humans and gods to have faith in the law of karmic cause and effect. Those who desire the pleasures which come from merit must have faith that the 10 wholesome actions are the sublime cause and that human or deva rebirth is the pleasurable result. Those who feel drawn to the void calmness of nirvana must have faith that its primary cause is the understanding of the cause and conditions of arising and ceasing, and that its holy fruition is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Those who would delight in the fruition of Buddhahood should have faith that the practice of the six paramitas over three kalpas is its major cause, and Bodhi and Nirvana are its right fruition. Okay, basically, everything in the scholastic sects, he says, is based on causation, karma. But then he says, right faith in the patriarchal sect is different. It does not, this is Zen, of course, it does not believe in conditioned causes or effects. Rather, it stresses faith that everyone is originally a Buddha, that everyone possesses the impeccable self-nature, and that the sublime essence of nirvana is complete in everyone. There is no need to search elsewhere. Since time immemorial, it has been innate in everyone. As the third patriarch said, this is from the Affirming Faith in Mind that we chant, a little different version. The mind is full like all of space without deficiency or excess. It is due mostly to grasping and rejecting that it is not so now. You can see how it is that the Zen school, could be considered radical. Until the teaching of Zen, there had been more of this, Buddhism had been more based on merit. You do good things and you acquire merit. If you do bad things, you lose merit. Your fortunes rise and fall based on what you do. And you can only hope that if you do enough good, that someday, probably not this lifetime, but some other lifetime, you can come to enlightenment and become a Buddha. But then Zen comes striding in and says, from the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. No matter what we do, this is our essential nature. Bright, luminous, endowed with wisdom and compassion and virtue. We don't have to earn it. It's not an accounting sheet. By all means, there is still the operating of the law of causation, but that has nothing to do with our original nature. So we have Shakyamuni under the Bodhi tree crying out at that on that morning when he glanced up and saw the planet Venus in the sky. Wonder of wonders. Fundamentally, all beings are Buddha. From the very no beginning time, we all have been endowed with this enlightened nature. It's just because our mind is turned upside down through delusive thinking that we fail to see this. Life is not a ladder that we ascend or descend, evolving or devolving, to change our status. Our status is fixed. We're all Buddhas. Always have been, always will be. This is the very bedrock of faith in Zen. It's not so much faith in the Buddha as a person, although that's part of it, but faith in our own innate Buddha nature. And then Chinyu continues, once we have given rise to right faith, we must add understanding to it. As Yan Shao said, to have faith but no understanding increases ignorance. To have understanding but no faith increases wrong views. Then Chinyu says, consequently, we know that once faith and understanding are merged, entrance onto the path will be swift. Well, let's just break this down briefly. To have faith but no understanding increases ignorance. We know that there are countless people in the world who have strong faith in whatever, but it's based on ignorance and increases ignorance. There are people who have faith in the American exceptionalism as placing us in some divine special category. And this has engendered countless terrible things. Goethe, a German writer, philosopher, said, there is nothing more frightening than ignorance in action. I thought of this many times under the reign of George Bush. To have understanding but no faith increases wrong views. Well, to have, to be so certain about one's own views can lead us astray. So we need to balance these two. The question is, what does true mind mean in the teachings of the patriarchs? Chinyu says about this true mind, sometimes it is referred to as oneself, for it is the original nature of sentient beings. Sometimes it is named the proper eye, that's EYE, for it makes visible all phenomena. At other times it is called the sublime mind, for it is empty yet numinous, calm yet radiant. Sometimes it is named the old master, for it has been the supervisor since time immemorial. Sometimes it is called the bottomless bowl, for it can survive anywhere. Sometimes it is called a stringless lute, for it is always in harmony. Sometimes it is called an inextinguishable lamp, for it illuminates and disperses delusion and passion. Remember, these are descriptions, names for our own nature. Sometimes it is called a rootless tree, for its roots and trunk are strong and firm. Sometimes it is referred to as a sword which splits a wind-blown hair, for it severs the roots of the defilements. Sometimes it is called the unconditioned kingdom, for the seas are calm there and the rivers clear. Sometimes it is named a wish-fulfilling gem, for it benefits the poor and distressed. Sometimes it is called a boltless lock, for it shuts the six sense doors. It is also called a clay ox, a wooden horse, moon of the mind, and gem of the mind. It has such a variety of different names that I cannot record them all. I'm going to read a footnote about a few of these. A stringless lute. The spiritual qualities inherent in the mind essence are like a melody played on the finest of lutes. This essence, however, requires no strings to sound its music. The strings here would be conditioned things. And because these qualities are always present in the mind, at any time it is in harmony. A rootless tree. When the roots of a tree are strong and firm, they plunge deep into the earth and are invisible to the human eye. Hence the tree is seemingly rootless. Nevertheless, this invisible root system supports and nourishes the entire visible structure of the tree. Similarly, the essence of mind, though unmanifest in the conditioned sphere, supports the mind's function, which displays the mind's qualities in all their manifold aspects. The unconditioned realm, the mind is originally calm and clear, referring to its innate void calmness and numinous awareness. It is only because of the commotion of defilements and the wind of passions that this original clarity is lost. In its fundamental, unconditioned state, the mind is like a calm sea and a clear river. Now, that's enough of those. Then he just adds, if you penetrate to the true mind, you will fully comprehend all of these names. But if you remain dark to this true mind, all names are only a block. Consequently, you must be precise in your investigation of the true mind. Question. We have learned the names of the true mind, but what is its essence like? In Zen, Buddhism, there is this distinction between the essence of the mind and the function of the mind. It's a very basic way of distinguishing these two aspects. So here, Chinul is addressing the essence. And again, he continues quoting liberally. From one sutra, he says, he quotes, "The essence of true suchness itself neither increases nor decreases in any ordinary person or Buddha. It did not arise in an earlier age and will not be annihilated in a later age. Ultimately, it is constant and eternal. Constant and eternal. This is our nature, the essence, our essential nature. And then Chinua comments, according to this sutra, the original essence of the true mind transcends cause and effect. It connects past and present. It does not distinguish between ordinary and holy. It is free from all relativity, all discriminations, you could say all categories. It pervades all places like the vastness of space. Its sublime essence is settled and calm. It transcends all conceptual proliferation. It neither arises nor ceases. It neither exists nor does not exist. It is unmoving and unshakable. It is still and constantly abiding. It is uniformly calm and still. It is free of the slightest flaw or obscuration. All the mountains and rivers of the great earth, the grasses, trees, and forest groves, all phenomena in creation appear from within it. In Sesshin, we can get a glimpse of this unmoving, unshakable, still mind, this true mind. It may just be seconds. So quickly it passes, but what a confirming experience it is to experience this stillness. And then Chinua continues, if we have faith in this, we should realize that all the bodhisattvas of past, present, and future are studying the same thing, this mind. All the Buddhas of past, present, and future have the same realization, the realization of this mind. The teachings elucidated in the Tripitaka all elucidate this mind. Tripitaka refers to the whole vast canon, our collection of texts in Buddhism. The delusion of all sentient beings is delusion in regard to the mind. The awakening of all practitioners is the awakening to this mind. The transmission of all the patriarchs is the transmission of this mind. The search in which all the patchwork monks of this world are engaged is the search for this mind. If we penetrate to this mind, everything is just the way it should be, and every material object is fully illuminated. But if we are deluded in regard to the mind, every place is inverted, and all thoughts are mad. This essence is not only the Buddha nature with which all sentient beings are innately endowed, but also the basic source of creation of all worlds. Just to pause here. In the Buddhist texts, as often we read of this Buddha nature referred to as the womb of all Buddhas, in that it all phenomena are created, arise from this mind. And then he says, when the world-honored one was momentarily silent at Vulture Peak, this is when he held up the flower before the assembly, when Subhuti forgot all worlds below the cliff, when Bodhidharma sat in a small cell in wall contemplation, when Vimalakirti kept silent, all displayed the mind's sublime essence. And then a question. We have now learned about the sublime essence of true mind, but what is meant by its sublime functioning? Chino. At all times and in all activities, whether traveling east or west, whether eating rice or putting on clothes, whether lifting a spoon or handling chopsticks, whether looking left or glancing right, these are all manifestations of the sublime function of true mind. And we can add plenty of other examples. When doing kinhin, when using the toilet, when getting up from bed, when brushing the teeth, all manifestations of the sublime function of true mind. Ordinary people are deluded. When putting on clothes, they only understand that they are putting on clothes. When eating, they only understand that they are eating. In all their activities, they are deceived by appearances. Hence, they use the sublime function of the mind every day, but do not realize it. It is right before their eyes, but they are not aware of it. On the other hand, one who is conscious of true nature has no further misunderstandings in any of his actions. As a patriarch said, in the womb it is called a fetus. On being born it is called a human. In the eye it is vision. In the ears it is hearing. In the nose it is smelling. In the mouth it is talking. In the hands it is grasping. In the feet it is running. When expanded, it contains all of the Dharma Dhatu. When contracted, it exists within one minute particle of dust. Those who are aware of it know that it is the Buddha nature. Those who are not call it soul or spirit. This line where he says, when expanded, it contains all of the Dharma Dhatu, meaning all phenomena, reminded me of a verse in the Mumonkan where Mumon says, lifting his leg, he kicks up the scented ocean. Lowering his head, he looks down on the four dhyana heavens. His body is so big, there's nowhere to put it. And then he goes on with more examples from the Zen tradition. Master Dao Wu's dancing with his tablet, Master Shi Kong's aiming a bow, Master Mi Mo's holding a pair of tweezers, Master Chu Ti's raising a finger, Master Xin Chao's striking the ground, Master Yun Yan's toy lion, all were displaying the great functioning of mind. And we have some footnotes here, one or two funny ones. This reference to drawing the bow is Master Shi Kong had originally been a hunter. After his enlightenment, whenever someone asked him about the Dharma, he would draw his bow and aim straight at the questioner. and this Yunyan about the toy lion. Whenever students came to ask him about the Dharma, he would tease them with a toy lion carved out of wood. I'll have to try that sometime. And then another question. If everyone is endowed with the essence and function of true mind, how is it that sages and ordinary people are not the same? Chinyu, the true mind is originally the same in the sage and the ordinary person, but because the ordinary person endorses the reality of material things with the false mind, he loses his pure nature and becomes estranged from it. Therefore, true mind cannot appear. It is like a tree's shadow in darkness, or a spring flowing underground. It exists, but it is not perceived. That's a wonderful analogy, like a tree's shadow in darkness. It's there, but it's not there. And then he quotes Sung Chao, another previous master. Between heaven and earth, within the universe, is contained a jewel. It is concealed in the mountain of form. And then Chino says this refers to true mind amid entanglements. Then he quotes another master. Ordinary men originally possess the Dharmakaya, which is identical with that of all the Buddhas, but as they are screened from it by falsity, they have it but do not recognize it. This innate Dharmakaya, means Buddha nature basically, which is present within the entanglements of defilement, has been given the name Tathagata Garbha, Buddha nature. And then he quotes another guy, this is actually not a master. He might as well be, because this is what he says. Ordinary people are those who are fully enlightened the whole day long without ever knowing it. And then Chinyu adds, therefore we know that even amid the troubles of the dusty world, the true mind remains unaffected by those troubles. Like a piece of white jade which has been thrown into the mud, its color remains unchanged. Question. The questioner quotes Xuanzi. The mind's heat is like a blazing fire. Its cold is like frozen ice. Its speed is such that it can pass beyond the four seas of the world in the twinkling of an eye. In repose, it is like a deep pond. In movement, it flies far into the sky. This indeed is the human mind. And then questioner says, this is Xuanzi's statement concerning the fact that the ordinary person's mind cannot be controlled or subdued. We are not yet clear, however, through which Dharma method the Zen school proposes to gain control over the deluded mind. And Chinyu says, the deluded mind can be controlled through the Dharma of no mind. This goes right to the fundamental in Zen practice. The last thing we want to do is try to control the mind as we would ordinarily think of that. We don't need to control it. Remember, its nature is utterly unmoving, unshakable, at rest. Doesn't need to be controlled. What we need to do is get out of the way and let it settle. Let it assume its natural state. We do this through absorption in no mind. No mind is that which is beyond our conscious discriminating mind. And that's what all of our different practices all have in common. Breath practice. When we're doing breath practice, we are dwelling in no mind. When we are doing mu, we are dwelling in no mind. Same with who am I? What am I? Same with shikantaza. This is all no mind. A stillness that is beyond discriminating consciousness. It's not a matter of tinkering with our thoughts or anything else in the mind. We don't have to work with it. We just need to refrain from feeding this consciousness. But the questioner doesn't understand this. He says, if people have no mind, they are the same as grass or trees. And then Chino says, when I said no mind, I did not mean that there is no mind essence. It is only when there are no things in the mind that we use the term no mind. It is like speaking of an empty bottle. We mean that there is no thing in the bottle, not that there is no bottle. We do not say that it is empty to express the idea that it is made of no material. And then he quotes the great Chinese master Dershan or Toksan. If you have no concerns in your mind and no mind in your concerns, then naturally your mind will be empty yet numinous, calm yet sublime. And the Chino comments, it is mind in this sense that is meant here. Accordingly, we refer to the absence of the deluded mind, not to the absence of the true mind's sublime functioning. I see that our time is up. We'll have to stop now and recite the four vows.